And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hey, everybody. I am Phil Lernis, and this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And I almost said coming at you from down under, but really, whether he's down under or not, he's coming at you from the down low. I got nothing. Should we start over? No, we don't edit. Anyway,
from the down low.
What I'm trying to say is it's the Motor City Madman from Motown, Hitsville, USA. It's TV's Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Fantastic. And next weekend, it's the Dream Cruise, where the major street fills with vintage and cars and a 28-mile traffic jam, self-induced.
Why are you pushing that when you won't even be there to see it?
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, you'll be gone. Where will you be?
I'll be in Knoxville, Tennessee, home of Alien Expo in Knoxville.
I've said this before, but as my groomsman Mike Stewart said, Knoxville may not be his favorite place on Earth, but it's definitely top two. So you are in for quite a treat. It is spectacular, Knoxville, Tennessee. So congratulations to you. I'm envious. I wish that I could have come to meet you, but still haven't been given the all clear to be able to fly at altitude. I guess I could fly at sea level, but because of the pressure on the ball, on the eyeballs. I almost said on the balls. Pressure on my balls. I do need pressure drops. But that's a different show.
Oh, wait a sec. The surgery is so sensitive that the pressure would explode your newly constructed eyes.
Oh, the first thing they have to do, they check in with you 24 hours after just to see how the healing's going on. But also they press on the eyeball to check the pressure, the internal pressure. Yeah. The pressure after the first surgery on my left eyeball was so severe that they had to reduce the pressure. I didn't tell you this, and their method for doing so?
What's the method of reducing pressure in your eyeball other than a syringe to reduce the pressure in your eyebrow?
Yeah, they jabbed me in the eye with a syringe.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Stop it.
No, that's it.
I can see why you spared me that detail, and I wish you did again.
Yeah. That's it.
Squinting.
In fact, I guess anything under 20 is a measure of pressure. I don't know if that's pounds per square inch. I don't know. But anything less than 20 is okay. And I was at 40. And I was feeling it. And so the surgeon, quickly brought me in, put my head in one of the apparatus, and I'm used to it. You look through these things, and they they're doing measurements. You're reading eye charts. You do all manner of things while your head is in this apparatus, and so I'm not expecting anything. And all of a sudden, something hurts, and I said, "Ow, that hurts!" And she said, "Yeah, it does." And the next thing I know, she's holding with her hand my head in place as she does it again. And I don't know what it is, but it doesn't work. So she leaves, and there's been a doctor shadowing her. I've told you this, right? That every time I go, there's a different doctor shadowing her because my case is so rare that everybody wants to learn about it. And so this doctor looks ashen. And I look at her and I said, are you all right? And she says, I didn't expect her to stab you in the eyeball with that needle. And I said, that's what she did? And I looked at Lil and Lil nods. Like, I had no idea. I didn't see it coming because I was in this apparatus, right?
Right.
And it came from the side, came from my periphery. So anyway, but that's what it was. And the third time was the charm. And the interesting thing was the time that worked in relieving the pressure, that jab didn't actually hurt. But the first two hurt. And so I had more of a scar from that than I did from the surgery itself.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know if we should continue telling stories of your eye surgery for our audience. Hey, I would think
it's all well and good. You know, I'm getting back to being myself now. I think it'll be 3 weeks this Wednesday since my second surgery. I am really starting to feel like myself again. I'm up and about. I'm walking every day over the last couple days, especially not only the productivity coming back, but mentally my ability to shift gears quickly from one task to another, which was really one of the last things to come back. And it was, I think, a product of having been in pain for so long. You know, leading up, of course, to the surgeries, I was starting to be in massive pain every day because I was straining to see anything. Then I got the first eye fixed. And, you know, there was soreness and then, like I said, this pressure that needed to be alleviated. But there was post-surgery soreness and the eye would strain and things. But massive pain was caused by the tension, the conflict between my surgically repaired eye and the other eye, which now couldn't see anything. And my brain was trying to make sense of those two things. And so it was just like somebody was holding a fist in the middle of my head all the time. So then I get the second surgery, and I think, okay, well, massive pain is going to be a thing of the past. Well, not so fast, not so fast, because now, seeing through both eyes, I'm seeing way too much, way too quickly, and everything's coming at me way too fast in a way that I'm not used to. So just the nonstop stimulus was something that I had to adjust to. So it was a good week of pretty radical pain there. And I don't, as you know, take painkillers.
Right.
And I would never say to anybody, you shouldn't take painkillers unless you want to be cool and tough like me. But I will say this, that the surgeon did remark on what a fast healer I am. And I said, I think that's probably because I don't take painkillers. So I'm aware of every little thing. And I'm aware of, okay, I need the medicine. I need the drops now. I need, you know, so I'm really sensitive to the things that you're not supposed to do. Like, you're not supposed to bend down. You're not supposed to bend over. You're not supposed to lift anything heavier than a book. I mean, no strain. It's surprising. You learn how many things actually will cause strain to your eyes that we spend most of our lives not aware of.
Yawning, I would imagine. You can't yawn.
Oh, yeah, can't sneeze.
No sneezing.
No coughing. Like,
hiccups? Bet hiccups are bad.
I mean, you have just eliminated, basically, as you know, four of my six or seven favorite things to do.
I know. And you often do them all at the same time. That's the weird thing.
Oh, my goodness. It's part of my one-man improv show. So anyway, so thanks for asking, but I am backing around and all, feeling, it just feels good to feel like myself again. And like I said, to be able to start going for long walks. I'm not doing any hikes yet, any off-road hikes, because anything where I might stumble or my footing might not be solid.
A twig in the eye. A twig.
Well, I'm not worried about that because I do wear protective eye gear, but just, you know, anything where, you know, look, if bending over can strain your eye, then I would imagine, you know, steadying yourself on a fall would do that. So we're working up to it. But with it, it means my energy is coming back, my stamina is coming back, and just being free of pain, it's so nice to feel like I have my mind back all day.
Yeah. Right? That's good. So you're mindful again.
Yeah, I mean, heart goes out to people that deal with chronic pain. I mean, my God, whether you're dealing with it, you know, handling it through medication or not, I can only imagine just the struggle to feel like your mind is not your own.
Yeah,
and it's just and keeping your God, keeping your spirits up when you feel like your mind is not your own. I mean, I can't imagine it. But then again, welcome to America in the 21st century. And I guess that's a perfect segue to the fact that we're recording a show last week talking about the horrible massacre in El Paso, and checking my Twitter feed, I see while we're recording that the news is broken that during the wee small hours of the morning, there was a similar horrible massacre in Dayton. And I just don't have the energy even to bring it up while we're recording.
No, I know.
But an amazing thing happened to me in the wake of that, Dean, which was I sat down, turned on the TV to watch the coverage of Dayton, and I realized just how numb I had become.
And I know.
And I like to think that I couldn't be to this kind of violence. But I realized I had become numb. And the way I realized I had become numb was because while watching the reporting on the Dayton shooting, I started sobbing uncontrollably for about an hour and a half. And I realized that was the straw that broke my emotional camel's back. And I now was feeling all that I had become numb to for what, the last several months, year? Who knows?
I know. That's the thing. An emotional response is called for every, not just the big ones, the small ones. There's a crime every day. There's tragedy every day. And to feel it, sometimes you got to just shelve that stuff and save it for another day.
Well, there is a degree to which, right, that the individual stories, and this is why we love stories, right? Stories about individuals can affect us more in some interesting ways than some of these big, horrific disasters that require you to try to wrap your head around it. And And as you're wrapping your head around it, your heart has been given free, free sanctuary to get the hell out of town.
Right.
But I feel like a long time ago we had the conversation that, you know, where gun violence in America is concerned, every solution ought to be on the table. And I would just like to double down on that. Like, I feel like everything should be discussed, right? I mean, from, not only background checks and red flag laws and banning assault weapons, but forcing people to be licensed and have insurance. That's a big one that I've been talking about for a long time, right? Because it's not just that might not stop mass shootings, but in America, irrespective of these mass shootings, right, 100 people a day die from gun violence.
Right.
And a lot of these bring about civil cases in addition to criminal cases. Can you imagine if people were forced to carry gun insurance and insurance companies were going to have to pay for this? Oh, my God, the insurance companies would clean this shit up so fast. They would never insure a bad bet.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They would do the background checks, the mental checks, that you couldn't get insurance if you had any sort of record. That's actually really smart and simple solution. It is not the government taking away your guns. It is the free market determining how and where and paying for the medical costs of all these gun actions all over the place.
We've talked before, right, about how the name of the game seems to be to make things be in people's financial best interests in order that they will do the right thing.
Right.
I also, the Second Amendment debates about for well-regulated militia, blah, 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 the right to bear arms of the populace will not be infringed. Okay, fine. But we all know, Dean, that guns don't kill people, bullets kill people. So I see nothing in the Second Amendment that prevents us from just outlawing ammunition.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Or the old Chris Rock bit. Make the bullets $5,000 each. Have all the guns you want, but that bullet's $5,000. You got to really consider before pulling the trigger. Is that worth $5,000 to shoot someone?
Interesting. That's wow. What a What a demeanor. Who, I mean, a demeanor? What does that mean? I don't know. That was a weird word choice right there. Dilemma is what I meant. Like,
I
mean,
$5,000.
Okay.
It's a funny bit, and it's so true.
Yeah. I mean, that way, what's good about it is, again, you're supporting the financial infrastructure. Companies can still make money because people mm-hmm. will buy the bullets. I mean, pretty much, you know what it's going to do is it's going to eliminate the amateurs and it's going to keep only the professionals, right? Because the professionals, their clients will pay for the ammunition.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, okay. There's that.
Hey.
Anyway.
Should we listen to a clip from 12 years ago, Dean Haglund?
Oh, my God. Let's have a listen.
Last week, you'll recall, we played a clip from Chilpak Hollywood Hour number 14 when we were talking about the best in science fiction movies, although we spent a long time before getting to that. And on this week's show, going back 12 years, Chilpak Hollywood Hour number 15, we were supposed to be talking about the very best in science fiction television. Give this clip a listen.
Yes, it is.
Without any further delay, why don't we get cracking on our all-time favorite science fiction television series?
All time. And it's we were supposed to narrow it to 10, weren't we?
We are.
I don't know if I really got that, because there's so many, and there's so many obscure ones, like, low on the list. Low. Could be off the list. It might not even be in the top 10. This is a show out of Canada called Lex. Now, the pilot was fantastic, and the show's writing sort of dribbled off. Shot in Halifax, had a really cool opening premise of a lost romantic race. There was one guy left who was frozen, who had special powers, and the nerdy engineer who was flying the ship with the sexy reptilian.
What does that sound like? Sorry.
Bastard. And a robot who was, it had it all, and the pilot was great, and the rest sucked.
So not one of the 10 best television series then.
But my point being, there's so many obscure sci-fi television series.
That had promise, that had potential, that you're trying to call attention to.
Right.
Plug, and that's fine.
But so first, the top 10 would have been the final two-hour episode, which was almost a standalone movie, of Babylon 5. Like, that sits around the 10 area for me, because that was fantastic. But the rest of Babylon 5, I watched, but didn't really go crazy for. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Now, I actually think I did see that final two-hour episode, and my awareness, what I'm remembering is that I was aware that it was well done, and I was aware that it was kind of lost on me.
Well, yeah, you did have to know a little. You had to have a little understanding of what came before. But still, as a standard, in terms of special effects and the final shootout laser battle fight spaceship thing was incredible for a TV show,
right,
that they had that kind of money. And it was early CGI work. And it was pretty phenomenal.
I had exactly the opposite experience then with the finale of that show that I had with the finale of Quantum Leap, another series I did not watch. And I watched the finale and knew that I was missing nothing and that it sucked.
Did Quentin Leeds suck?
The finale, anyway. I mean, people love the show, but I gather, and it'll be interesting to hear from maybe our listeners, I gather that it was fairly unsatisfying, a conclusion, which is, let's face it, which is the rule, not the exception.
It's true to most series,
beloved series. They often feel the need to, when I say they, I mean, the creators, the makers of the show, the writers and whatnot, often feel the need to conclude things in a way that will make the audience happy. And in so doing, however, betray the reality of the characters.
Yes.
Because the quote-unquote happy ending, even if it's what you've been wanting to see, it isn't coming organically out of the characters themselves.
True.
And an
Sopranos
audience knows that.
Being the case in point, what every writer aspires to in terms of ending a series is Newhart, where Newhart ends, all the characters are crazy, and then he wakes up in bed with Suzanne Pluchette from the Bob Newhart Show. It's a callback.
Right.
25 years. Hilarious. Best ending of any TV series anywhere.
Right.
Except in Babylon 5, I thought, ended well.
You know, I mean, that's an interesting, It's late August. I'm exhausted.
Yes.
I think it would be an interesting conversation, actually, to just compare all the final episodes of TV series.
Saint Elsewhere ended with the everyone panning away from the hospital. It's snowing. And then it's in a little snow globe, and there's a little kid playing with it, and it's all been inside a snow globe and imagining
it. It was interesting. I remember the last episode of Hill Street Blues being great, but so many series, the final episode is disappointing.
Disappointing. Seinfeld,
yeah. You know what was interesting about that was that the characters remained true to who they were. However, the writers and the creators were commenting upon that.
Right. And it's almost as if they just got drunk the week before and just sort of paraded out everybody, had an excuse to parade
right.
all the favorite
just think
characters.
They really were commenting on them, especially with how they end up in jail at the end. And it was more of an idea rather than an expression. And for Seinfeld, of all things, if you wanted the idea to be that these characters are never going to change no matter the circumstances, then you just have a normal episode.
And there it was, our segment of Futures Past, once again in delicious, delightful, spellbinding two-channel mono.
Yay, two-channel mono.
So
it does get this oriented.
I thought you had fixed it. Like, we started in two-channel mono, then we did some episodes in actual stereo, and then we're back to two-channel mono. It's fantastic.
You know, I forgot why it was flipping like that. Wasn't it one of the softwares that we were mixing? Audacity or something kept the channels separate. I don't remember.
I don't know. I just remember that you always would tell me when I would ask, how's the audio? And you would say, oh, it looks great.
Yes.
And it was years before I realized that that's not an answer. Somebody should have headphones on and be listening to it.
It looks like all the little squiggly lines are in the range of nut.
So this could not more fall under the heading of the more things change, the more they stay the same. this was, I guess, our first ever effort at a top 10. And you, right from the outset, acknowledged that you couldn't do 10.
Right.
And
yes, there's plenty. And couldn't rate them. So some are low, some are high. Low and high. So, you know, they're somewhere in there, you know, because really, do I really want to give it one mark below and one mark above for this one or that? You know, I get it. I still do it. I'm not a rate.
So although I would still, you know, I would take some serious exception to the idea that, you including shows that by your own acknowledgement were not good, but because you enjoyed an episode of it. And I would take that exception on the basis of, I guess we could call my theme, one episode does not a series make. Nevertheless, it got us into this discussion about what makes a great finale, and we were off and running, and for crying out loud, just a couple of weeks ago on this show, here we were talking about this very damn thing again, almost 12 years later.
Oh my God. Because it's hard to land a great finale. We, you know, there's plenty of examples of non-committed, you know, like I were talking about Seinfeld. And then what else comes to mind? Sopranos?
Well,
the Newhart.
I mean, I love. Yeah, you brought to mind the Newhart. There were some different finales in there that we mentioned that were cool, like Saint Elsewhere. Anyway, so I just think that that's interesting. Like 12 years later, here we are. We're still.
Well, yeah, we talk about the hardest things in showbiz to do, right?
Yeah,
still trying to wrestle with it.
Yeah, and. How fascinating, because you had come from a TV series that had wrestled with this same thing.
Right.
Or so you had thought. When you appeared as a ghostly figure peeing on the side of the road in The Truth, right? At the end of the X-Files run, not so fast. It wasn't the end of the X-Files run. They would still need to try to figure out how to do a finale.
And they still, you know,
yeah.
And do they have to figure out a finale? I don't know. Does that show ever end? I think now it's sort of such a open-ended a thingy thing.
Well, no, I mean, I think they did end a lot of it. They did end a lot of this time. This is always the mistake, not always, but it's often the mistake of bringing things back. You know, by defining things, by answering things, do you reduce the mystery? I mean, think about 2010, which is a good science fiction adventure film, but doesn't it serve in some ways to reduce the mystery and the majesty of 2001 by trying to come up with solutions? So anyway, we'll still be wrestling with this, I think, 12 years from now. When you're trying to figure out how to conclude the long-running 12-year improv streaming series Gravity Hole.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. We are going to go live sometime this week. Not sure when, but on numerous platforms, our 20-minute sci-fi comedy that ends every episode exactly the same way. Just, you know, something we learned from the Muppets. When you don't know how to end a sketch, just blow it up. That's what you do. So,
what else did you learn from the Muppets?
That commenting from an upper balcony is hilarious.
I knew you would go to that. We are kind of those guys.
I know, right? Armchair directors, you suck. That sucks. There you go.
Crackin' wise from the balcony. all right, let's revisit a couple of topics since this is very much the theme. The more they change, the more they stay the same. Let's just revisit a couple of recent topics so that we can discuss some recent developments or updates on them before we drop into the Chill Pack Morgue, and then finally get to roll up our sleeves and discuss some movies.
Yay.
The Writers Guild battle with their agents is now in month four, Dean.
I know.
And the agents are doing literally nothing to negotiate, right? I mean, they seem to be just expecting the writers to back down. And I don't know why that is. I mean, what an odd...
Yeah, why would that be an expectation? Because, you know...
Is the White House behind their strategy planning? I mean, it makes no sense at all. And the Writers Guild, indeed... I mean, I guess, you know, we do live in a time where it is all about fomenting discord in the ranks of your opponents, right?
Right.
It's what the Russians are doing in America. It's what political parties traditionally have done with their opposition parties, right? This is, even in sports, you'll see teams use the public medium to try to sow discord between the players on an opposing team. And so I think there has been an effort to do this, but in reality, after 4 months, the support for the Writers Guild leadership is overwhelming, and to stave off any potential dissatisfaction or disaffection, people like Adam McKay have gone on record with spirited, inspiring, stirring, and profoundly accurate, historic statements of support for what the Writers Guild is doing and standing for in this. So there don't seem to be any cracks in the support here in month four.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, the longer it goes, the more the writers are going to realize that they don't need an agent, that you can negotiate these things with a lawyer, and that if they're continuing to get work and studios continue to hire the writers and so on and so forth, even if the agents negotiate something, there is no upside to a writer going back to an agent if he's already working and it's all functioning great, you know?
You're right. And the agents are the ones really with something to lose, i.e. packaging power, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you can't package a bundle, a director, a writer and a couple stars in a project anymore and put your studio brand or your agency brand as the production arm, all that will be lost. You still have to then, and if there's tons of bad blood, those writers are going to, you know, demand top dollar, and they're not going to take that discounted thing because they're packaged in the agency's production arm. So it's just going to cost them more money. I can't believe they're dragging their feet on this.
So shifting gears to the big screen, we've been talking about the future of movie going and how to address the box office apocalypse and how subscription services seems to be an answer. Variable pricing at theaters for different types of film might be an answer. Certainly, although MoviePass was a model financially seemingly doomed to failure, it did prove some things that a subscription model could work, that people want to go to the movies. AMC, Regal, and oh my goodness, I'm forgetting. Is it Cinemark? Have all created their subscription memberships. This is also a Netflix model that people are used to, and an Amazon Prime model, a Hulu model, a streaming model for the big screen. That makes sense if they can find the financial point that allows everybody to get healthy. And apropos of this, a smaller theater chain, but a very influential one, has come to Los Angeles at long last. And this is Alamo Drafthouse.
Yes. The Alamo Drafthouse experience. It is a theater, a bar, a comedy. It's a live stage experience with a screen in the back.
And a very successful company. I mean, they are the part owners of Neon, a film distribution company. Tim League of Alamo Drafthouse and my old friend Tom Quinn of Magnolia started Neon. I think probably their biggest film to date was the Oscar-nominated and Oscar-winning I, Tonya. They do a lot of great documentaries, which makes sense given Tom Quinn's background and expertise with documentaries. They're going to be releasing Bong Joon-ho, Snowpiercer's new film theatrically in October. So an exciting film distribution company, Neon, that is partnered and partially owned by Alamo. And as I mentioned, Los Angeles now has a flagship location of Alamo Drafthouse in downtown LA, across the street from the 7th Street Metro stop in the old Macy's Plaza there.
Fantastic. Finally opened, did it? They seem to be forever working on that.
And you enter through a video store. A video rental store with thousands of titles. And those titles are utterly free to rent for Alamo Drafthouse members. And how do you become a member? Membership is free for Alamo Drafthouse. So you go through the video rental store, which also sells cinematic memorabilia of a wide range of prices. Before you get to the Alamo Drafthouse. Now, so you get a Alamo Drafthouse membership. I think it's probably like a, you know, like an Arclight membership. Yeah. It doesn't give you discounts, except that maybe, you know, frequent viewers, you get points and you probably get some discounts, or you get some discounts off your concessions that way. But it also entitles you to sign up for the subscription service they are going to be launching.
What?
That apparently, for something along the lines of $25 a month, allows you to see up to one movie a day.
What? That's fantastic.
It's fantastic. And of course, they know how they make their money and the ways they make their money. These cinemas show the best big budget studio films. They show the best in independent, the best in foreign. They show revival. They are state of the art 4K digital projection, as well as they have the ability to screen on film. And what else do we like about them? Oh, we love the fact that not only do they have a rule of no phones, no texting, no letting that goddamn screen light up during a movie. Never mind the sound. People don't understand that that light is very distracting.
Right.
And not only do they have the policy that you are not to do that, they have people standing by watching during the movie so that if that happens, you will be, and make no mistake about it, you will be kicked out.
Madonna, for example, was famously kicked out for using her cell phone during a screening of something. She caused quite a tiff. She was quite upset about the whole thing.
Yeah, she should go fuck herself. That's what I think. I think the lowest rung of hell is reserved for people who think it's all right to check their messages during a movie.
Right.
You know, we didn't need to check our messages during a movie back during the 70s and the 80s, Dean. And sure, you might say it's because we didn't have the technology, but I say it's because we were capable of living in and savoring the moment. We were people enough for that. All right.
Remember that? Living in the moment.
So that's very exciting.
That is exciting.
And now, if I can bring the room down for a minute, it's time to open up the Chill Pack Morgue.
Celebrity deaths.
All right, we have two celebrities whose lives and legacies we need to celebrate. One, I'm only going to mention in passing, and that's the iconic documentary filmmaker D.A. Pennebaker, the first documentarian ever to be awarded a Lifetime Achievement Oscar. He died at 94, and we're not going to talk about him because, and this is very exciting, we're going to do a special theme show next week where I think, unless I'm mistaken, it'll be the first time we've ever dedicated an entire hour to the art of documentary filmmaking.
Wow. That's a lot. A whole hour.
And,
considering,
well, I mean, we're going to need more than an hour considering the fact that we're welcoming a special guest, a professor of documentary film. What could be more exciting?
Ooh, scholarly, one would say.
And in anticipation of that, Dean, what movie did I watch this week?
A documentary, perhaps?
Perhaps one of your favorites. Perhaps your top film of 2011, Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Oh my gosh. My mouth is watering just thinking about it.
Just thinking about me watching it? That's creepy.
No. About that, I think, you know, it's been a while since I've seen the movie, but man, that guy, he looks, every sushi on camera looked so delicious.
So we will we'll celebrate the life of D.A. Pennebaker at the outset of that show. Probably the first question we'll put to our guest is, D.A. Pennebaker, why should we care? All right.
Excellent.
But the other name that we need to mention, legendary novelist Toni Morrison.
Oh, yeah.
No,
that was a shock.
Nobel, was it a shock? Had you been in recent contact with her?
I had not. So you're right. It wasn't that big a shock.
She died at 88. She was the Nobel Prize winning author of such best-selling novels as Beloved, Song of Solomon, and The Bluest Eye. Her critically acclaimed books told powerful stories of Black lives in America, all of which tended to hit just a little too close to home for you, Dean.
Yeah, really? Yeah. I'm not sure.
Oh, my God. But by the way, we're at a time with no small amount of overt and out loud hostility, it seems, between the races in America. And I was reminded yet again in this particular instance while watching some of my best friend's wedding on Showtime last night.
Okay.
Specifically the scene where every one of the characters breaks into song. In a restaurant, singing Say a Little Prayer, the Dionne Warwick hit, led by Rupert Everett. I was just reminded again of how I am astonished that the white race was never slaughtered. Okay. because I see things like that, and I say, God, we had it coming. All right. Was that dark? Is that dark?
That's really dark. Dark.
I don't know.
Yeah, again, the Hollywood fantasy, you know, their racial bias, blindness, systemic whatevers, yeah, that took a while to get around that.
I mean, you hear the thing white culture, and I've always maintained there isn't one. And then you see that, and you go, okay, well, if there is, it's a contradiction in terms. All right.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that my best friend's wedding is the same stain on the soul of white America that slavery is. I'm just saying it's close.
Oh my God. You know what? I don't think I've seen the whole movie. Now I got to see it if it's such a train wreck that you say it is.
But enough about me. And Toni Morrison, she had the distinction of being the first black author who had a book chosen as a main selection of the Book of the Month Club since Richard Wright's Native Son 37 years earlier.
Wow.
Her most recent book was God Help the Child, and she also in 2015, and she also wrote nonfiction, children's literature, and plays, including Desdemona. She became the first woman ever to win a Nobel Prize when she won it for literature in 1993, winner of and recognized with many other honors, including the National Humanities Medal in 2000, the Library of Congress Creative Achievement Award for Fiction in 2011, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2012. Toni Morrison, iconic, I think it's safe to say.
Iconic indeed.
All right, Dean Haglund, we've been teasing it, we've been hinting it, we've been dropping little nuggets into the mix for the last several weeks. I want to hear your thoughts on Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Wow. Yeah. You know, there's lots of, you know, when I draw a picture sometimes and I get really into the details of the scene I'm looking at, and I'll draw each leaf on the tree and I'll lovingly color the sidewalk with all its little pebbles and scratches gray. And then I'll step back from that drawing that has all these details, and the thing just, you know, I forgot to compositionally think about where the tree should go and the sidewalk should lay. And then it's not that great a picture. I think I'm drawing something fantastic, but you take one step back and you go, oh, Jesus, you know, just throwing as many details in there, you forgot to do something. And so that's my review right there without spoiling. Notice I didn't spoil anything with the metaphor of an over detailed drawing. I just said that that's.
Well, no, there is no way to spoil anything in that movie by talking about the first, what, 2 hours and 20 minutes, two hours at least. You can talk in detail about the first 2 hours and you're not spoiling anything. No. I mean that in the sense that everybody's concerned about plot spoilers, and there's nothing about that happens until the third act. And it's one of the reasons, as I maintained earlier, that the third act is really the problem with the film. I would say that the ending, the twist ending, is maybe one of the most fun sequences, but it's also the problem with the movie. And as I want to talk about in a minute, it's utterly, to me, it at least borders on being repellent and offensive.
Yes.
And the treatment of Bruce Lee goes full on into repellent and offensive. And is shocking in its racism, but it's at the very least unfortunate. Let's put it that way. But here's a movie, first of all, that assumes something I don't think anyone other than filmmakers and show business people ever assume. Only we ever make this assumption, and that is that what we do for a living is interesting.
Right. Well, and this is goes back to write what you know. And if you spend your life as a writer, you eventually only know writing for film. I mean, and you've run out of things you know. So,
but for Tarantino, who really has lived his life as a cineast, as a student of cinema, what he really knows is his study of cinema. So right. What he's writing about is literally his study of cinema. And
right.
So it's replete with his ideas of cinema, not necessarily expressed through character or story.
Yes. I guess. There's character.
There is. But I'm just saying that a lot of time, look, what resonated with me about your description what I thought about was that there's a point in this movie, and it's a significant length of time in this movie, but there's a middle section in this movie where the three leads are all, Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate, the real life Sharon Tate, Brad Pitt as a stuntman, Cliff, and Leonardo DiCaprio is the former television leading man, Rick Dalton. And there is this about an hour-long segment, I think, in the middle of the film, where the three characters are leading disparate little adventures. And it's all set during, you know, a very brief period of time, this movie. But on that final day, some amazing things happen. And it's Rick Dalton on the set of a TV Western, where he's playing another in a series of bad guys that he plays. And it's him breaking down. And that breakdown.
In the trailer.
Yeah. And that breakdown preceding breakthrough where he does some of the best work of his life. And we see that. And that is intercut with Cliff, played by Brad Pitt, taking a sojourn, a day trip out to Spawn Ranch. An old movie ranch in the valley with a hitchhiker who happens to be a member of the Manson family. And he takes it upon himself to look around on that ranch to see if the ranch's owner, the real-life Mr. Spawn, Cliff had worked with in the past, to make sure that he is okay. And that's a role played by Bruce Dern. It was supposed to be played by Burt Reynolds. Burt Reynolds died the day before he was flying to Los Angeles to play that role.
I did not know that.
And so that's going on. And at the same time, Sharon Tate has gone to Westwood to go to a rare bookshop where she buys a book. Famously, one of the last things that Sharon Tate did was buy as a gift for her husband, Roman Polanski, a first edition of Tess of the D'Urbervilles, as a love letter to his deceased wife, he would make into an Oscar-winning film 13 years later.
Right. And also, unfortunately, Sleep with the Star.
So she then passes by a theater where her movie that she's in, a Matt Helm movie starring Dean Martin, is playing, and she decides to go in and watch it with an audience. And one of the coolest things Tarantino does is to have it be the real Sharon Tate on screen that Margot Robbie is watching, and there's no problem with it. It works great. And I think all three of these sequences are riveting, heart-touching, funny, scary, emotionally affecting. All three of these sequences are Tarantino at his best, and it shows how rich the characters are because we care about what we're doing. And it's all wonderful, and that's the middle section of the movie.
Right.
And it's ultimately all I take away as mattering in that movie.
Well, because, and here's your thing, and this is a narrative function. You don't see how those things affect the next act. I mean, it's weird that these emotional breakthroughs, that these moments of success, of like you said, breakthrough, that doesn't inform anything that happens next. It's kind of weird. It's sort of standalone.
Now, before I let go of the Bruce Lee depiction, one of the things that really disturbs me about it is not just how he's depicted. Because the defense that Tarantino has made, By the way, the scene where Cliff's character fights Bruce Lee and throws him into a car, as written, as directed, as choreographed, was Cliff wins the fight and beats the shit out of him.
Yeah.
And Brad Pitt refused to play the scene that way. He said, at the very least, this needs to be a draw. Because he knew this was utterly disrespectful. You know, to have a character, a real life character that is a hero and an icon to so many, but especially to a group of people that have been sorely, almost criminally underrepresented on screen in this country. To do that to that character is really wrong and really hurtful to a large percentage of the population, especially as just a gag. Now, Tarantino has defended it by saying, look, I'm not using it to insult Bruce Lee or to say Bruce Lee is anything other than as great as he was. What I'm trying to show is how tough and how badass Brad Pitt's character is. Okay, I understand that idea. What unfortunately comes forth is two kinds of blindness. One is the blindness of racial insensitivity, realizing that you're doing what everyone in Hollywood traditionally has done, which is taking people of color and using them as props to literally prop up the tough guy bona fides of a white hero. And so that's offensive. But the second thing that is shocking to me is the blindness involved in doing that when you have actually had a scene in your movie about how that's happening to Rick Dalton. He's being used to be a punching bag for younger, newer actors to prove how tough they are. And we're meant to feel that that is unjust. We are meant to feel the sadness for Rick Dalton in that. But we're not allowed to feel that sadness towards Bruce Lee, who Quentin Tarantino is using in the same way. So there, I've said my piece about that. Wish the whole thing had been cut out. And also, it's so confusing for so many people in terms of the timeline. It is literally just shoehorned in there in a way that we don't need to know. We know that Brad Pitt, as a 50-something stuntman, despite no doubt chronic pain, is a badass, because those guys were, period. Right. So
yeah, there's less safety anythings and all that sort of thing. So there's no safety concerns back then.
So anyway, we then move forward to the whole twist, without spoiling it, it's horrible. It's offensive. And here's why. You know, I feel like it's Tarantino chasing Tarantino. You know, he openly references almost Inglourious Basterds through a movie that Rick Dalton does, where Rick Dalton takes a flamethrower to a bunch of Nazis. And the flamethrower pays off nice. Like I said, the climax of the film is, quote-unquote, fun as a standalone. But whereas Inglourious Basterds rewrote history, but did it in this alternative way where the people that died continue to die. In the Tarantino version, it's how they die that maybe gets to be a little bit more satisfying and a little bit more of a wish fulfillment for people, right?
Yeah.
But to argue that, for example, because I'll stay away from what happens, but to argue, for example, that the LoBianca murders, which took place right before Sharon Tate and her guests were murdered in real life.
Right.
To say that the LoBianca murders never even took place, to never even mention their name, to just use the Manson family as a motherfucking plot device.
Yeah.
Is to utterly disregard the pain of and trauma of entire groups of people.
Right. And so this is the thing. I mean, you know, it's a Tarantino revenge porn phenomena, a category, a genre unto himself. And by, like you said, in my mind, there was a second outcome in that the next night, Charles Manson family would be attending the Tate house, and, you know, and that was the instigating factor. But I agree with you wholeheartedly that this, not rewriting, because in Glorious Bastards, it was, was fun, but it continued to fulfill a deep urge that you wanted all this time. In this movie, there was no, did you want the Manson family to be wiped out?
Here's the urge that he fulfills, and it's a noble urge. I will say this, and this is how he got the approval of the Tate family to use her life rights. He has always thought that it was a historic crime that she has been relegated to the dustbins of history, a footnote to the horrible acts committed by these murderous people.
Right.
And in his eyes, if there was justice, no one would know the name Charles Manson, but people would remember and celebrate the wonderful qualities that Sharon Tate brought to the screen. And that is a noble urge. I would argue that if what you want to do, though, is to celebrate Sharon Tate and make sure that she's not forgotten, well, you could have ended the movie after she finished watching that screening of herself.
Right?
That would have been so. That's the happy ending. And then that sends you out wanting to learn more. But it doesn't give Tarantino a chance to be Tarantino. And it's really interesting because, you know, he said that this will be his next to last movie. And, you know, I almost felt like he has the climactic sequence that he does because he's feeling the pressure to be Quentin Tarantino.
He's reading his own press.
Well, not necessarily that, but he knows what people want from him. And he has that voice of, if I don't give them what they expect, then they won't come. And I think everybody gets into that, right? When you get rewarded, you feel the pressure. Actors understand this, right? This idea of recreating performances.
Right.
And so, but his heart doesn't really seem to be in it, right? I mean, it's incredibly tame as far as Tarantino revenge porn goes.
Right.
It's we're used to the revenge porn making us uncomfortable, which at least gives it to me some real reason for being, because it makes us uncomfortable even as we're enjoying it. This doesn't. This could have almost been directed by anybody, that final sequence.
Interesting.
And so it's almost like his heart's not in that, which means maybe he's right. It is almost time to leave the stage. Because the kind of movies he wants to make, he's not going to be able to make because his art form has been killed off by a pack of teenagers that have murdered movies, which is why he's interested metaphorically in the Manson family. But as much as I usually don't like dealing strictly in the positive and therefore bring forth the negative, I've been very seemingly negative about this movie, and I want to talk about something that Tarantino did right that I salute. And we talk about this movie as much because, as we do, because it's not about whether a movie like this is good or bad, whether it works or doesn't work. As we've said before, when you are in the hands of a great artist, a great storyteller, their failures are going to be more interesting than most people's successes, right? And this movie is interesting. There's no question about that. But one of the things that I really salute, Dean, is that Manson himself is such a minor character.
Yes.
And that he's just a loser. He's just a whiny loser. Because this fiction has been drawn up, starting with Vincent Bugliosi's prosecution of the case and his terrific novel about the prosecution of the case called Helter Skelter. But a fiction was fabricated that has become accepted as fact that Manson was some sort of Svengali, some giant cult leader. And the truth of the matter was he was a desperate loser. And he was a whiny loser. He was no mastermind. He literally sent these disaffected and full of rage teenagers and just basically pulled the pin and said, go kill these people and make it look witchy. There was no real cult element involved.
Right.
It was just a murderous rampage of disaffected, rageful youth, the kinds of which we're seeing in El Paso and Dayton and Gilroy and places like this, right? It doesn't take much. There doesn't have to be a mastermind behind it. Sometimes there just needs to be someone giving the right hate-filled speech and the right rhetoric that says, oh my God, he understands how I feel. So that when you make the suggestion, go kill those people, then it happens. But he was terrified to even take part, right? He hid out while these things were going on. I think he's the only person, I mean, maybe people who have hired hits, but he's the only one that I know of that was ever convicted for first degree murder without ever actually killing anybody.
And
the nature of it was that they were deemed to be his weapons. Those kids were deemed to be his weapons. But it's not true. And so I like that he's the minor, insignificant little whiny loser that he really was. And Tarantino gets that right.
So that's a smart move. And rightly so. I mean, if he's trying to reframe the argument or reframe history, as it were, there's no other way you could do it. You can't make Manson a dynamic or a great bad guy. He has to be a minor figure in the whole movie. So
let me ask you this. Quentin Tarantino, a great filmmaker?
Let's see. A studied filmmaker, lots of information, scholarly, scholarly. But in the Kubrick great,
I'm so glad that you mentioned that name. I mean, I wrote down Kubrick without the ideas.
That's funny, actually.
And something that's been bouncing around in my head. You said revenge porn. Lily said something about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. She said it moved from revenge porn to nostalgia porn.
Right?
The movie really suffers from nostalgia porn. The other thing about it, the ending, now that I think about it, here's evidence that you haven't figured out how to end a film when you can't figure out how to end the title. On screen, it's, I think, Once Upon a Time, ... in Hollywood. On the poster, it's Once Upon a Time in ... Hollywood. The official title is without the dots altogether. So how does it end? But anyway, I would absolutely say that Quentin Tarantino is one of the greatest living directors. He's one of the greatest contemporary directors, right? And filmmakers. Yep. But when looking at the arc of cinema, is he in the pantheon? Or is he the next tier down? And so it's interesting. I think you would probably agree with me that he's next tier down.
Well, and historically, how are we going to, the movies, different movies resonate 20, 30 years down the line that were overlooked at the time that, that did bad at the box office, but now are hailed as classics. The list goes on and on. And I don't know if anything's going to resonate down the line for any of the movies. There's, you know, maybe Reservoir Dogs, but even that starts feeling a little paper thin once you see all his movies back to back, you know.
And it borrowed so heavily from a Hong Kong film. So I'm stuck with the fact that Pulp Fiction in some ways holds up unbelievably well. And in some ways it's even better now than when it came out. And in other ways it's even more of a sedative now than it was then. I bring to attention the entire Bruce Willis segment, for example. It's interesting because his movies, you're right, they're so about movies, and I'm not sure that them being fundamentally first and foremost about movies might be actually the thing that has prevented Tarantino from breaking in to that, again, that pantheon of filmmakers. I mean, I'm at this moment sitting here looking back at his output, I'm maybe saying that Inglourious Basterds is his top masterpiece.
Really?
Yeah. What would you say?
Well, I'm liking lots of sequences from Kill Bill, but am I liking the whole film together? There's, you know,
Are you counting it as one, or are you counting it as two?
Well, I'm counting it as one. It's just a long one.
Yeah, but as I think he does, right? When he says this was the ninth film, I think he does the same thing. Anyway. But there's an interesting case too, isn't it? That when part one came out, I thought, oh, this is a horrible mistake, having split part one and part two. And then part two came out, and I went, well, you know what? I loved part two. I'm really glad that they were split up. But so putting it all together, it's almost like the Godfather saga when Coppola edited the first two Godfather films in chronological sequence, and the effect was to strengthen Godfather one, but weaken Godfather two. And I feel like putting parts one and two of Kill Bill together would have done the same thing. It would have strengthened part one, but weakened part two.
Interesting. Isn't that something?
And that, again, means that he's not failed, but he hasn't fully closed his fist. He hasn't made that perfect masterpiece. Anyway,
right.
It's just interesting because he has been such a dominant figure in film, and because he is going to be leaving the scene, and I take him at his word on that, it is interesting to start to appraise then, since film history matters so much to him, where does he stand in film history? I've been thinking about that also with other, you know, filmmakers, like what contemporary ones might I say stand with the greats or have a chance to stand with the greats, you know, and we talk about some of them from time to time, obviously P.T. Anderson, your Wes Anderson, anyone named Anderson. How about Coen brothers? I mean, we should do a whole show. Well, maybe we will at some point. Let's just do a whole show on the Coen brothers someday.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
I mean, that'll hold up for sure.
But one of the voices that I wonder, because you can see the lineage, right? You can see, we mentioned Kubrick with Tarantino. We also know he loved Howard Hawks. He loved Sam Fuller. He takes his influences from these. But I often wonder, in the age of franchises, in the age of box office, but at a time when independent voices can find distribution in a wide variety of avenues, do we have anyone who is really worthy of being in a discussion with John Cassavetes?
Wow.
And why does that matter? Maybe it doesn't, except right. that, you know, the Indie Spirit Awards give the John Cassavetes Award. So if you're going to give that award, like the Robert Altman Award, well, then you're saying that someone should be in Altman. Paul Thomas Anderson is our modern day Robert Altman.
Right.
But what, and we see that influence. He wants to be Robert Altman, and he often directs like Altman would have directed. But what about Cassavetes? And it's fascinating because I would never have expected, if you told me where this guy gained his fame and how he gained the money to make his first movies, that that's who he would have been. But I got to tell you, I think Sean Baker, who most recently made The Florida Project.
Oh, yeah.
That he is both the heir to John Cassavetes, and he's young enough where he may end up in the Pantheon someday. Florida Project was a masterpiece. His film before that, Tangerine, the first feature-length film filmed entirely on iPhones. Oh, my God, that was a movie that Cassavetes would have been proud to put his name on.
Right.
And I've gone back, interestingly, since I first watched Tangerine, and then I saw The Florida Project. And so now I've been going back from Tangerine to watch his entire filmography in reverse order. So I can get closer to the origin.
Right. Starlet and Prince of Broadway and all those.
Yes. And today I finished watching Take Out. A film in Chinese. And what you love is that he's drawn to stories about, it's not just that he makes these films in this neo-realistic style, this handheld style, creating the intimacy of Cassavetes, that he likes working with real people, non-actors, let's say, and has become quite adept at, a la The Florida Project, at taking major actors, Willem Dafoe, and mingling them with non-actors to great effect, which was what Cassavetes did. But it's also what I love about Sean Baker that I feel is very unique. He's not the only one, but it's it takes a lot of balls. It takes a lot of interest in life and humanity. He is drawn to people on the fringes of society, and in our economic reality, there are no shortage of stories to be found there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, now I'm going to do the same thing you're doing, going back and taking a look at a lot of these things. So,
and I guess we should say, I mean, I buried the lead, but for people who don't know, Sean Baker comes to fame and makes the money that finances his first couple films by being a creator of Greg the Bunny.
Wait, what? Greg
the Bunny.
The cartoon series?
Yeah, the cartoon series. Yeah.
You're kidding.
No.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's why Greg the Bunny actually has cameos in some of these movies, too. Yeah, that's where he gets his fortune. That's where enough to, and he puts it into these movies. And builds a movie career. And it's...
That's funny.
So, 12 years from now, when we play a clip on this show, who knows? Maybe we'll be going, oh, yeah, remember that guy? What happened to Sean Baker? Dear God, he got bought and sold, and then that was all she wrote. Or 12 years from now, we may be dogged by cunning foresight, and we'll be talking about how he belongs in the Pantheon. I could certainly see that happening because, again, what he's drawn to, these stories of humanity on the fringe, under pressure. There's no shortage of stories. You talked about the importance of writing what you know. Well, it also can be go out and learn about new things and write about that. And he seems really driven to do that. And just the empathy and the compassion and the humor and the attention and attraction towards the good, the bad, and the so-called ugly that make up what it means to be human. It's all on display. And so I can't wait to see what he does next. And with The Florida Project, I thought Starlet was a real misstep for him. That's his one weak film, even though it got better reviews than Prince of Broadway, but that's because it was set in L.A. and about the porn industry, and we love movies about ourselves in Southern California. So... But I would say that it was a failure on a few levels. It was the one where it was all actors, and we lost some of the verisimilitude. Yes, there's an elder lady in it, and that is someone on the fringe. but a budding porn star. Yes, you can say that porn is on the fringes of society. In some ways it is, but it's so celebrated in our culture.
Right.
That it doesn't feel fringe in the same way. And so I thought it was great that he kind of responded to Starlet by stripping it back down and almost starting over again with Tangerine. You can't strip it down more than by going all iPhone. Yeah. And then recentering himself, refinding himself, he then shoots on film and has scope to it while still having intimacy in the Florida project.
Right. Fantastic. Okay. All right. I'm sold.
Cool. Well, that brings us to the end of another hopefully interesting installment of Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, which is now we're going to change the name to Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour and a Quarter.
Yes, because you always go over.
The people love it. The people love it. I mean, I always had a recommendation for a film out in theaters now that I didn't even get to.
Oh, my God. Well, let's save it for next week's show.
Well, we won't have it on next week's show because we're going to be talking about documentaries on next week's show.
Okay, the week after then.
Okay, when it's no longer in theaters, but you'll be able to find it streaming. So look forward to us talking about Lulu Wang's The Farewell, starring the fantastic Awkwafina, in 2 weeks. Next week will be all about documentaries. Until then, I am and shall remain your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness.
And I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.